Waypost, 3120 North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. I'd like to first of all introduce all of our hosts. So if we could all go around and give our names and our preferred pronoun, and if we have any announcements or anything that we'd like to share, we'll start with that.
All right. Well, I'm Nicolette Schweizer and I prefer A and M pronouns.
My name is Rowan Everard and I prefer he and him.
My name is Natasha Delapine. I prefer gender-neutral, masculine, and feminine pronouns.
My name is Emma Lugo, and I prefer she and her pronouns. And we also have someone at in the studio with us that we're just going to just acknowledge that she's here, and that's you prefer she.
Yeah, I'm Jean Bryant, and I prefer she and her pronouns.
Thank you. So we have a special guest tonight. We have Julia Serrano. Julia Serrano is a writer and a very famous trans activist. She's the author of several books, and we're going to be getting into a lengthy discussion with her in just a minute. But first, is there any news or announcements that anyone would like to share?
The construction is finally done-ish at the Q Center, which means that the Equi Institute will be moving into our space officially this week. Yay. So we'll go from having one room to having five rooms, which will be super helpful for actually seeing patients. So yay, it's going to happen.
All right.
That was so exciting.
Yes.
I think something that has been on the news feeds a lot and is a really big deal for trans people is that in the last month, transgender people were recognized to be able to serve in the military. And people may have complicated feelings about that, but it's definitely within the category of something that people can do. It's important. So I'd just like to acknowledge that.
Totally.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, great. Well, let's get to Julia then. Julia Serrano. Hello, Julia. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, great. Thank you. Would you like to introduce yourself, Julia? You can probably introduce yourself better than we can.
Hi, I'm Julia Serrano. Pronouns preferred she, her, and I'm an author and activist and performer.
Oh, great. Thank you. And what are some of the books that you've written?
So I have two full-length books that are already out. My first book, Whipping Girl, A Transsexual Woman on Sexism and the Scapegoating of Femininity, which was originally released in 2007, has recently come out as a second edition. And my second book is Excluded, Making Feminist and Queer Movements More Inclusive, and that came out in 2013.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining us here at KBOO today. We really appreciate it. So we have lots of people with questions here, so we're going to just jump right into a conversation. Would you like to start?
All right. So, hi, Julia. I wanted to start with how I really enjoyed how in your book, Whipping Girl, you demonstrated how transphobia is caused by systemic misogyny, because I've observed the link between the two since before I even came out as trans. But to this day, when I talk to people about that subject, I still find a surprising amount of people telling me that systemic transphobia and systemic misogyny don't exist. So what would you say to those people to explain how they exist and what the connection is between them?
Sure. I would say that we live in a world where there are all these different double standards and forms of marginalization and hierarchies and so on that exist. And a lot of them are related to different forms of sexism, that is, double standards related to a person's sex, gender, sexuality. And sexism can play out in a lot of different ways. A lot of forms of sexism, what I describe in the book as traditional sexism, are based upon the idea that femaleness and femininity are seen as inferior to or less legitimate than maleness and masculinity. And I describe that as traditional sexism because that's traditionally what people think of when they think of the word sexism. But then there are all these other types of sexisms that exist that in the book I call oppositional sexism, that are based upon the idea that there are two and only two genders that exist, and that they're mutually exclusive, and that these two different genders, you know, man and woman, are associated with certain types of natural attributes that make them a particular way. And anyone who crosses those boundaries in our society face a different form of sexism that we might describe as transphobia, and I would say that most forms of homophobia are along those lines, where there's this idea that men are supposed to be one way and women are supposed to be another. And in the book, I talk about a lot of trans people's experiences being related to living at the intersection of both traditional sexism and oppositional sexism. And in my personal experience as a trans woman, when I am kind of walking through the world and people do not read me as transgender, I face a lot of types of sexism that most non-transgender women face, and that feminists have been describing for a very long time. But when people find out that I'm a trans woman, there's a specific type of sexism that in the book I talk about trans misogyny, which is this idea that it's a mixture of transphobia and misogyny that you can't necessarily pull the two apart. And it's basically steeped in the idea that it's not just people are ridiculing me or dismissing me because I'm a transgender person and I'm breaking gender norms, but also because since femaleness and femininity are viewed as inferior in our society, people tend to put misogyny into the types of transphobia that they might express towards me.
All right. Thank you, Julia. So as a follow-up to that question, obviously this would be a long process, but what do you believe we can do as members of society to begin to reverse systemic oppression of femininity and trans people?
That's a very good question. I think the first thing we need to acknowledge is, and I think we as a society in general, I think we've come to the terms with the idea that there is sexism, but I think when people think of sexism, they think of people purposefully being sexist, you know, where if you were to, say, fire somebody from their job because of their gender, that people would say, yeah, that's sexism. But the thing that we have a hard time wrapping our brains around a lot of times is the fact that these are ingrained in us and they often are unconscious, and we're not aware of the fact that we might be holding people to double standards. So I would say the very first thing that we could do is acknowledge the fact that we probably have some unconscious double standards by which we're judging people. And if you have some kind of feeling or comment that you want to make about whether it's feminine gender expression or whether it's transgender people or whether it's women, If you have some kind of comment in your brain that you're about to express, maybe consider for a moment, what would it sound like if you said the reverse? And if you find yourself wanting to say something really demeaning about one expression of gender that you wouldn't say about another, that's probably a sign that there's some kind of double standard at work going on in your brain, and maybe that's worth analyzing. And I think that starting from that point, doing self-work is a really good start. There's a lot of sexism and transphobia that goes on in the world, but I think it's important to start with ourselves, because we all probably have unconscious biases that we're not 100% aware of.
All right, great. Thank you, Julia.
Questions. Rowan, do you have any questions?
Yeah, my name is Rowan. I'm a trans guy living here in Portland. And I've been watching with chagrin, you might say, over the last few years as the trans-inclusive radical feminists among us have sort of, I don't know if multiplied is the right word, but like become more vocal, perhaps. And I think that maybe there's more of that here in the Pacific Northwest than there is in the Bay or in other parts of the country. I think I have a theory about why that might be, but I want to ask you, like, where you think this sort of most recent wave of these ideas came from, because I feel like they've been around since the 70s and probably before that, but it seems like there was a moment a few years ago where it sort of bubbled up. Like, do we blame Lierre Keith for all of that, or, you know, where did this all come from?
Sure, that's a great question. So I transitioned around the turn of the millennium, so around the year 2001. And around the time that I transitioned, while it wasn't necessarily true of the Bay Area, which was, compared to most places, fairly trans-friendly, although I definitely experienced within feminists and queer spaces, some transphobia going on at the time. But in general, it was a more trans-welcoming place. But around that time, and especially prior to then, it was pretty commonly accepted that ideas of being, even whether it's transphobic or trans-suspicious, maybe in some cases, those sentiments were really prevalent. And I think what happened was, as the alts were happening, there was a lot more welcoming and embracing of trans people, both within LGBTQ plus communities and within feminism, and increasingly within mainstream society. And I'm not 100% sure about why, at a particular moment, about 5 years ago or so, all of a sudden, the trans-exclusive radical feminist movement burst onto the scene. In my mind, I think that some of it might be the type of backlash that happens when a certain type of prejudice is commonly accepted, and then all of a sudden, it's no longer seen as acceptable to say that. I think that that's similar to what I feel is happening in this country to a certain degree with Trumpism, where there are a lot of, our country is becoming more diverse, and there's more acceptance of the fact that different forms of marginalization happen and they're bad. And so people on the fringes all of a sudden become a little more vocal or radicalized to try to adhere to that old prejudice that they've been holding their whole lives. And maybe that's what the trans-exclusive radical feminist movement is partially coming out of, that kind of a last remnant of you know, institutionalized transphobia. But it could also be other things. I'd be interested in, you mentioned your own particular theories about why that might happen. And I also do think that social media is a part of it too. It's really easy nowadays for a very small contingent of people to make a lot of noise,
yeah,
with regards to particular debates. So that could also be a part of it. Other than that, I don't have any one specific theory as to why it happened when it happened.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Natasha, do you have any questions?
I first would like to say I'm curious about your memories of being engendered in your society, that in your community, in your with your family, in your home. When I'm a kid, back in my early days, I remember being this a child who interpreted things based on a gender. It was how it was understood to be because of the television, for example, or how you were treated at school from a young age. Did you, I'm just curious if you have an example from your memory banks.
You sure? So just in general, you're asking me about my experiences being gendered as a child, or is there a specific
I'm curious about what you might have had an example maybe for us from your memory, from your childhood specifically.
Yeah, sure. I would say that in my case, and I should say just because people tend to have some familiarity with kind of a canonical, transgender story of the person who, knew their whole lives that they wanted to be the other gender and eventually realized that as an adult. And for me, it wasn't quite like that. I would describe myself as a child very much as a tomboy, meaning that while I was raised male and, I was told that I was a boy, and I sort of accepted it, even though there were definitely indications that I wasn't 100% happy with that or in sync with that. But for the most part, I had very gender neutral kind of nerdy interests. For me, my preferred toys were like dinosaurs and Legos. I wasn't especially masculine or especially feminine. And I was kind of a small child, and for me, I spent a lot of my childhood being seen as different in that I was especially small, and a lot of my early childhood was kind of managing that aspect of me being different, which turned out being helpful for the rest of my life in that I learned not to worry so much about what other people were thinking of me and to just be myself. And it wasn't really until I was about 11 around the time that I became consciously aware of what had been a lot of unconscious feelings about not identifying with being a boy and wanting to be a girl. And given that, I still just had I was probably seen as kind of, not necessarily androgynous, but kind of a very gender neutral-ish, tomboyish sort of boy. And so that was basically what I inhabited growing up. So I was never really seen as especially gender normative, but I wasn't seen as being especially gender nonconforming either.
Julia, thank you for sharing that. I remember reading Whipping Girl, and when you told that memory, it reminded me of how when I first read your book, it really opened up some space for me as a trans woman. And first, I'd like to say, I don't know if I gave you this informer before the show started, but trans positive is really the whole spectrum of where the people on the show are trans masculine, trans feminine, gender nonconforming, and intersex. And so we actually represent a whole spectrum. So when you get questions, you might be getting them from a whole spectrum of perspectives. And I don't know if I was clear about that when I first invited you on, but I just wanted to give you that informer. But when I read your book, Whipping Girl, I remember you talking about that experience of being kind of a tomboy. And I remember thinking about that, like trying to wrap my head around it, because I kind of had similar experiences as a child. And one of the things that Whipping Girl really did for me was it made me feel comfortable being a lesbian trans woman. I mean, it was hard for me at first when I was coming out to really say, oh, I'm a lesbian, I'm attracted to women, and everything in my culture is telling me, oh, if I want to transition, it must be because I'm attracted to men. And of course, one of the basic fundamentals of gender identity is that gender identity has nothing to do with sexual orientation. Sexual orientation is a completely different spectrum that is intersecting and, you know, has different kinds of connotations. So anyways, with that in mind, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Whipping Girl. What led you to decide to write it? And what came out of Whipping Girl for you? Because that was really what first put you on the map in the community, was Whipping Girl. It was a really breakthrough book within the community. And I remember in our groups, it was one of the first groups we came, it was one of the first books that we came to that we felt was really opening a lot of new ground in terms of gender identity theory. So could you just talk a little bit about Whipping Girl?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So for me, Whipping Girl, I mean, part of it was I had read lots of, you know, there are lots of kind of the standard, as I was talking about, like transsexual, you know, memoirs, et cetera. And for a lot of them, I could never really find myself in them. Part of what, you know, you mentioned, you know, like being kind of a lesbian identified trans woman, that's something that is outside of that canonical story. I mean, nowadays people are a little bit more familiar with that, but at the time there was just this one standard story. And I didn't necessarily want to tell my story. I think a lot of times as trans people, we get stuck in these boxes of, you know, well, you're supposed to tell your story. And I think it's fine for us to tell our stories. But I didn't necessarily want to specifically tell my story, but I was observing a lot of things around that time that I did want to talk about. And for me, a lot of that revolved around the ways in which what I talk about in the book, trans misogyny, the way in which that plays out, I felt like there wasn't really a lot of talk about that. I feel that trans activism around the time, we talked a lot about challenging the gender binary, and that's very important. The gender binary is a mindset that definitely negatively impacts trans people all across the spectrum. But I felt that there wasn't a lot of talk about the ways in which misogyny might come into play. And for me personally, I was turned on to trans activism by my experience being at Camp Trans, which was the longstanding protest of the Michigan Women Music Festival's Women Born Women policy, which basically excluded trans women from attending. And part of what I experienced as a queer woman in the community at that time was a certain amount of acceptance of people in the trans masculine spectrum, while at the same time a kind of a dismissing or even a ridiculing of people on the trans feminine or trans female spectrums. And I wanted to address those issues, and I wanted, I guess, to get more, I guess I kind of wanted to dissect a lot of issues that hadn't really been talked about. I think that another aspect about writing about trans issues is a lot of times we're writing for mainstream audiences. And when we write for mainstream audiences, it becomes a little bit more of a transgender 101 sort of explanation, because you're talking to people who don't have a lot of awareness or knowledge about trans issues. And I wanted to pick apart some more complicated aspects of that. And so as a result, Whipping Girl, I definitely tried to make it as accessible as possible, and I've had people tell me that they found it easy to get into, but at the same time, I kind of dig into a lot of issues with regards to gender and sexism that I think really need to be addressed, but can't really be addressed at a more superficial level, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Rowan?
Yeah, I have another question, sort of follow-up to my last question, but also related to Whipping Girl for sure. You say in Whipping Girl that you aren't going to theorize as much about transmasculine experience because it's not your experience. And I hear that, but I also imagine that you still have some thoughts. And I've been wondering about how to think about the sort of tortured relationship it seems like the queer women community has with transmasculinity, where there's definitely, on the one hand, like there's this overprivileging of it in the sense that particularly like soft butch, and I think that like sort of, this is not a technical term, but like gently masculine people have a lot of cachet culturally and a lot of dating cachet particularly, but that there's also this intense feeling of like this narrative about butch flight, for example, where it's like, oh, we're losing all the butch women because they're transitioning and woe is us because we missed the halcyon days when people couldn't transition and they were really unhappy and we got to date them and not have to have our sexualities feel complicated. But also just this feeling of like, well, you guys are betrayers because masculinity is bad and femininity is good, and now you're transitioning, which means that it's bad. And it feels so murky and complicated, but I wonder, my sense of that is that it's like there was this period in the 80s where butches and femmes were exiled from feminism for quote-unquote reproducing heteropatriarchy. And then in the 90s, people were like, oh, we're not doing that anymore, but we never really like talked about it and were like unpacked like what happened and whatever. And so it just feels like there's a lot of like weird unexamined baggage, but I wonder what your sense of that whole thing is.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that, you know, there were ideas that kind of started in the 60s in both, like, feminism, especially kind of in queer communities, about what I sometimes in my writings call the reinforcing trope, which is the idea that sometimes within marginalized communities we accuse some people of reinforcing the system, whether it's reinforcing the patriarchy or the gender binary or heteronormativity or whatever. And there was definitely a period of time, which was before me coming into the community, where, you know, butches and femmes were seen as reinforcing gender roles. And when I came out to the community, there was definitely, as you described, kind of an acceptance or even sometimes a celebration of butch and femme. But at the same time, there was still a lot of baggage that I feel like we're still working through. And it is kind of sad that now we're in 2016 and we're still having a lot of, it seems like there's still a lot of, for lack of a better word, like turf wars or debates about, you know, butch versus femme or trans men versus trans women and, you know, visibility versus invisibility, which a lot of this is based on. I think a lot of times it's very easy to say, oh, well, you know, trans women, they're really visible, you know, like every time you watch a TV show and there's a trans person, it's a trans woman, you know, there's all that visibility. And then at the same time, invisibility can be good because sometimes that means that you're not facing as much public scrutiny. And trans men tend to have more of that, right? And, you know, and especially with, like, femme identities, femmes are really visible, but there's a lot of negative aspects to being visible. And so our communities are working through all these issues, and I do find it distressing when people, I think that there are really useful conversations to have in here. I wish that they wouldn't kind of rip the community apart so much as to just be constructive conversations. When I was coming into trans communities, it was around the time where, you know, basically trans women within the community kind of had most of the, you know, the power and the visibility. And trans men were very much marginalized, and a lot of that was related to, at the time, it was harder for trans men to access the gatekeeper system.
Right.
And then it kind of flipped around, and as trans people got a little bit more, became a little bit more accepted within a lot of kind of feminist and queer spaces, as you're talking about, like kind of like gentle masculinity or soft butch, however you want to put it, had a certain amount of cachet, and there was a certain amount of kind of trans men being accepted more than trans women. And I think it's important to talk about all this, but like I said, I definitely think that we should try to be talking about it in ways that are constructive, and that rather than just kind of saying, oh, you're privileged, and it just, I think all of us have privilege and all of us are marginalized. And rather than divide ourselves up, I think it's important to acknowledge that we're all marginalized in certain ways and have constructive conversations about that.
Yeah, I guess I just, it feels whenever I try to talk about it with people, like it's such an angry red thing. And I'm always trying to think of like, how can we de-escalate this a little bit? Mm-hmm. So I just wonder if you've had any success doing that.
Yeah, I think that with a lot of conversations, I think that if people have a lot of anger and if they're palpably feeling that anger at the moment, then a lot of times the anger is going to come up no matter how you approach the subject. Yeah. And we've all been hurt, and all of us have, you know, felt anger, and there have been times in my own personal experience where maybe on a particular issue I wasn't in a space to have more nuanced conversations about an issue. But I do think starting from this standpoint of all of us have some privilege and all of us are marginalized in certain ways is a good place to start. And also to recognize what we have in common, even if there are differences that drive us apart. And I think for all of us, whether it's within a whether it's a trans man, trans woman conversation, or whether it's a binary versus non-binary identified trans person conversation, or whether it's a within queer communities or within feminist communities conversation, I think that we can start at the point of, look, there are systemic forces that are working against all of us, and we have that in common, and all of us in some ways in our lives are privileged and in other ways we're marginalized. So if we start there, I think that maybe we can have some more nuanced conversations about these particular issues without it necessarily overriding everything else that we do have in common.
Totally.
All right, so yeah, this is Nicolette again. I had one more question for Julia. I found that since coming out as a non-binary trans person, I mean, you know, it's something I've just kind of known my whole life, that I've just never felt like I was male or female fully, but just a little bit of both. And the reason I couldn't talk about that for the longest time is because, you know, how our society just enforces this idea that there's only two genders and there's no other options. And so, you know, I felt like I'd be talking about something that doesn't exist. You know, I came out recently with all the discussion about non-binary genders that's been happening more through our communities and through the internet in recent years. And, you know, it's not that these genders are anything new. It's just that now these terms for things that have always existed are more out in the open and being acknowledged. But even with that new information starting to get out in the open, I still find that most of the time when I try to explain to people that I'm non-binary, most of the time I get people telling me that I'm just following a trend, or I'm confused or mentally ill or trying to get attention, blah, blah, blah. You know, so what would you say, you know, would be your suggestion as to how we can begin to break down this myth that there's only two genders, and get society as a whole to begin to understand the whole gender spectrum?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think also, while that's always been an important question, I think that nowadays I find the trans acceptance that's happening in the mainstream that has happened has very specifically benefited people like myself who are trans people who identify within the binary and I think there's a certain amount of mainstream acceptance that are some people who, in their minds, were like, well, they were born a boy, but now they're a woman, or they're born a girl, now they're a man, right? And that kind of fits in, even though they don't necessarily 100% accept that or embrace it. I think that there's some acceptance that is an experience that some people have. And I do think that people who are non-binary identified, that is something that the mainstream just hasn't had as much experience with and needs to. And even within a lot of, you know, trans spaces or queer spaces, a lot of times there's still a certain amount of, reluctance to go along with it. I think a lot of times, you know, some of it is based on language. People's tendency, especially in our language, that we have specific male and female pronouns, and a lot of times people really stubbornly want to put up fights about gender-neutral pronouns. And what you were talking about how some people try to dismiss, you know, oh, you're non-binary identified, that's, you know, you're following a trend, or that's not a real thing. And people say that about anything that they don't quite understand. People have said that about people being gay and about, you know, all sorts of different identities that now are accepted. And so I just think that there are multiple different things, and it depends on the person, but there are multiple different ways that we can get the message out that actually people being non-binary identified is a real thing, that there isn't only two genders, that if you look at societies, you know, throughout the world and throughout history, lots of cultures had more than two genders as part of their societies. And, you know, people are reluctant and drag their feet or, you know, are unwilling often to go along with actual real people's experiences if, you know, they have some hesitation about it, or if, you know, they were raised in a world where, you know, there were only two genders in their mind. But I think that within our own communities, us accepting non-binary identities is really, really important, and us kind of pushing people at different levels to make awareness about that is really important. For me personally, in kind of the world that I live in, there's a lot of acceptance of non-binary identities, and I, in interacting with a lot of people, especially, I speak a lot at colleges, and I find more and more every year when I'm talking to these people who are at colleges, who are maybe like inviting me to speak, that people put their preferred pronouns at the bottom of their email signatures. Or I find people asking me, oh, what are your preferred pronouns? Which is really important. And I also think that that's also a recognition right off the bat, not just of trans identities, but of non-binary identities. So that is definitely another thing that can really help with that.
Julia, can you stay on through the end of our show? We close at 7, but we like to take a little break right now.
Okay, fine.
Great. So thanks. We're going to just take about a 3-minute music break, and then we're going to see if Jean wants to be included on the conversation. Jean has been sitting here very quietly, and we'd like to make sure Jean is included since she's here in the studio. So we're going to take a 3-minute break, and then we'll be back.
Love. can swing. Though nothing, nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
Hello, Julia.
Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for coming back and waiting through the break with us and listening to David Bowie. I'd like to continue our questions we had, continuing on the phrase that we were going on with gender and non-binary as well. From your experiences with the gender enders and on from that, myself being intersex and in the dark when I was younger, I grew up identifying as a biological trans person in a way, as I wasn't in any gender and I didn't know the language to describe my current state. This is when I was, you know, through adolescence and onward, and I got to identify with other people who are trans or on any other end of the spectrum. What do you understand being involved in the sciences, as well as with activism and performance, the cultural idea of the biology of gender? What do you have to say on that note? Anything at all that we can change our viewpoint or understanding because our culture ingrains a biological reason that may or may not have any standing?
Sure, yeah. I think that people, a lot of times, like to cite biology to, if they think that there are natural differences that exist in their brain, and I'm putting natural in quotes in my head. I'm making the quote sign with my hand, but you can't see it.
Yes.
And so people like to use biology to support the idea, well, there are naturally just two sexes and that's it. But in reality, biology is full of variation. And we like to, when I say we, I don't necessarily mean the bunch of us having this conversation, but we as a society like to say, well, it's really clear that, you know, that there are female and male sexes and that's it. But if you actually look at biology, for one thing, how do you define what sex is? And there are a lot of different things that people can point to. You could point the chromosomes, or you could point the reproductive systems, or you could point the hormones. And in any given person, these might not necessarily all line up the way that you would think they would. Both obviously in intersex people, but also a lot of times those of us who are trans who transition, they don't necessarily line up. When I go to the doctor's office and they give me the form to fill out, and when it gets to the kind of, you know, have you had a breast exam? Have you had a prostate exam? Like, you know, they're kind of two completely different sections, but for some of us, you might, multiple things from each section might apply. And in addition, I think that people have really strong feelings about their needing to be these completely mutually exclusive genders in order for biology to work, but that's not actually true within the biological realm. There are lots of species that have sexes that function completely different than we tend to think as human beings. So, for example, there are species where individual animals may change their sex over the course of a lifetime, sometimes in response to environmental cues. There are different species that have more than two sexes. There are animals that are hermaphroditic, meaning that they have functional female reproductive systems, both within the same individual. And so the idea that biology has created two mutually exclusive sexes and that's natural is actually not how biology works. And if anyone's actually interested, one of the most well-known science journals, it's called Nature, and a few years back they actually had an article that was basically talking about how sex does not occur in a binary within the biological world. And this is pretty well established as far as biology goes, although most people in our society are fairly oblivious to these facts.
Thank you, and I very much enjoy that you have some kind of scientific background, but also maybe some kind of evidence to have our listeners reach out to if you have any kind of recommendations for this biological understanding, for this to get more people in that are listeners to be readers about this as well. Do you have any recommendations for us to read?
Oh, sure, yeah. And I did mention that Nature article that is probably floating around. I off the top of my head, unfortunately, don't remember the title of that. But if you're looking for a book on this subject, I would definitely recommend Joan Roughgarden's book. It's called Evolution's Rainbow. And so she is a scientist who also happens to be a trans woman, and she talks about the ways in which different species fall outside of what we consider gender binary. And it's written very accessibly. It's written for, it's basically, anyway, if you're interested in science but not necessarily a scientist, the book is very readily accessible, and I definitely recommend it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Great. So this is Jean. And, you know, while I've been listening to the discussion, I pulled out my Kindle, and I actually brought up the final couple of paragraphs of Whipping Girl. And a couple of things jump out at me that I think feed very well into a lot of what you shared already, and especially this last discussion, piece of the discussion, where you know, you're basically celebrating the fact that we have a spectrum, we have a broad spectrum, and the beauty of the diversity and everything. So I'd kind of like to bring it back into the context of the queer trans community and activism. Because I'm going to read from the final paragraph for a moment here of your book, of Whipping Girl. Basically, after having pointing out that we're all entitled to our gender expressions, you say simply, by critiquing those gender expressions in an entitled way, we actively create new gender expectations that others may feel obligated to meet. And then in parentheses, you say, which is exactly what's now starting to happen in the queer trans community. And that is why I suggest we turn our energies and attention away from the way that individuals do or perform their own genders, and instead focus on the expectations and assumptions that those individuals project onto everybody else. By focusing on gender entitlement rather than gender performance, we may finally take the next step toward a world where all people can choose their genders and sexualities at will, rather than feeling coerced by others. I see, it's just such a wonderful conclusionary statement to your book. And, you know, while it certainly had a basis to make those observations at the time, it's somewhat prophetic. And I wonder what perspective you may have now that a little more water has gone under the bridge. And is anything that you would observe now on those same conclusionary statements?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that that's specific, some of what I'm particularly talking about there was particular to that moment in time, especially during the aughts. There was a lot of talk about especially the way in which ideas of queer theorists, for example, Judith Butler, or the way that those ideas of gender as a performance or all gender as drag, those were very popular sentiments at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And people were using those in a very self-empowering way to kind of create space for people to explore and experiment with their genders, and to create space for all different gendered and sexual possibilities. But then some people within those communities were judged because, oh, well, you know, you look very gender normative, like, oh, you're a transsexual who's like a feminine trans woman or a masculine trans man, so you're reinforcing or upholding, you know, gender norms.
Uh-huh.
And just the way in which sometimes our own ideologies within marginalized communities kind of create new hierarchies.
Uh-huh.
And I definitely have seen that happen over and over and over and over again since writing that, within different contexts. And I talk a lot more about this in my second book, Excluded, and specifically the subtitle of the book is Making Feminist and Queer Movements More Inclusive. And a lot of what I talk about is basically following up on that last chapter of Whipping Girl and talking about the tendencies we have within our own movements to constantly create new hierarchies where we're judging people often based on superficial ways of how we perceive them behaving with regards to, you know, how are you performing your gender or sexuality, and is your gender or sexuality kind of the cutting edge gender and sexuality, or is it more of a boring, normal, conservative gender and sexuality in people's eyes. And I feel that these conversations are both frustrating and they don't really get us anywhere. And I definitely maintain the idea that a lot of how sexism occurs in the world is through the way that we perceive, interpret, and treat people differently based on their genders and sexualities. And I think that it's that gender perception, which in that last paragraph that you read, I talk about it being gender entitlement.
Yes.
Just kind of the entitled idea that the way that we view gender and sexuality holds true for all people, that kind of perception that allows us to create different types of double standards is what's at the heart of sexism, and that's really where we need to focus on challenging both ourselves as well as challenging gender entitlement in other people.
I agree completely, by the way. We have tended to be our own worst enemies right within our own coalition.
Yeah.
For that reason. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, this is Ron again. We just have one last question. I wonder, you know, so much has happened just in the last year of our movement and in our country, obviously there's a lot going on, but I wonder, I know that when we won marriage nationally, there was a lot of fear in the trans community that like, okay, well now all the cis gay people are going to go away and they're going to abandon trans people and the right is just going to come for us and they're going to have a field day. And it feels to me like that hasn't quite happened in the way that some people feared, but I wonder, what do you think so far about the way in which our cis queer allies have shown up for us with all of the national bathroom bill craziness? And what do you think the national and state level organizing should look like in the next few years?
Sure, yeah. I would say that I think that I agree with your assessment that, you know, I definitely worried that there would be a certain contingent of, say, more like mainstream gay and lesbian people who would kind of lose interest after DOMA was overturned. And that hasn't necessarily been the case. I think part of it is because a lot of these bills that are being passed that affect trans people also do, in fact, impact the greater LGBTQ community. And, you know, for example, there was in Indiana recently, you know, last year, there was the, and I'm forgetting the actual words of what the bill was called. There was like the Religious Freedom Act.
Yeah, HB2.
It was basically an excuse for people to discriminate against all LGBTQ people based upon, you know, if their religious beliefs were against it, right?
Yeah. Also contained a lot of union-busting measures.
Yeah. And, yeah, no, that's, I should also mention that that was, you know, Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee who was responsible for that or
totally.
Part of that. But anyway, I definitely think that conservative forces, despite the overturning of DOMA, are still anti- not just trans, but LGBTQ people, although trans people are increasingly kind of more directly targeted. And unfortunately, especially transgender children, I think that in my lifetime, one of the most depressing developments of transphobia is the fact that a lot of these debates have shifted from attacks on transgender adults like myself who can stand up for myself or ourselves and focusing on transgender children, especially because there's governmental control over school systems.
Certainly. Well, I'm sorry, but it looks like we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Julia Serrano, for being with us.
Thank you again. This was a great discussion.
We're going to win in the end, I'm sure.
Okay.
Thank you for your for being on, and can we get your contact information for our listeners as well?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. So I have a website, juliaserrano.com, and you can find out everything about me and my books, et cetera, there.
And a really excellent blog also.
Thank you.
And then I just want to close out. My name is Rowan.
My name is Natasha.
My name is Jean.
My name is Nicolette.
And thank you so much and Emma Luego also for joining us for Transpositive PDX, and have a wonderful month.
You can find information at kvu.fm/transpositivePDX
or at facebook.com/transpositivePDX.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland Oregon's